This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right then, brains on, ears open, eyes wide. Are you ready? Good. Time for another Fun Kids Science Weekly. This is the show that's a bit like turning up to a private party at a secret rocket lab in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. You know, you're only getting in if you're interested in the most amazing, weird and wonderful things in the universe. My name is Dan. Hello. Thank you so much for giving us a listen. This week, we're learning about a tiny little single-celled bug that lives in the sea and it wants to snack on your brain. Also, we'll chat about a way that you can use the random inventions that are floating around your head to try and save the world. And we'll get the answer to one of the smartest questions that's ever been sent into the show. First, it's time to head deep down into your gut, though, with our germ friends Benny and Mal.
Good bugs, bad bugs, with support from the Society for General Microbiology.
Microbes get everywhere. They're on us, in us, and around us. If you've got a microscope, like me, you can see them for yourself. Look!
All right there.
That's Benny. He's a helpful sort of microbe. Lots of microbes are.
Not you again. Can't you leave us in peace?
And that's Mal. He's not very nice. A few microbes are horrible, and they're called germs.
Charming. I'm not all that keen on you either.
Hey, easy, Mal, mate. You're not doing yourself any favours there.
So, what's up, guys?
Well, what we thought would be quite nice is to introduce you to a few of our microbe mates, show you some of the shapes and sizes they come in.
And hopefully you'll catch a horrible, snotty cold and you have to stay in bed and stop bothering us.
I'm so sorry, he can't help it. It's just the way he is.
You're embarrassing me. Have you looked in the mirror recently?
So, microbes, we're really tiny. You could fit about 50 bacterial cells across the width of one human hair. Viruses are even titchier. Some microbes are made up of one cell. Some are more complex. And there's trillions of us across the planet.
And it would quite literally take a trillion years to show you every single one, because you look quite stupid and we'd have to talk quite slowly.
Now, come on, Mal, that's just rude. Do you want her to get the bleach out? Well, behave. Mal does have a point, surprisingly. There's so many we haven't got time to meet them all, so let's make it a little bit simpler and divide them into five main types. And we can introduce a few characters on the way. Type 1. That's your cue, Mal. Come on, this was your idea.
Fungi. Fungi are fun guys, or they can be. Lovely athlete's foot makes your feet all itchy and smelly. That's a fungus. Good friend of mine.
Fortunately, most fungi are helpful. Some of my helpful fungi mates are the decomposers. They break down dead organisms, which make nutrients that go back into the soil. If you have a compost heap, they'll be hard at work in there. Next up, algae.
Algae are microbes that live in watery places. What? That's all I've got.
You're joking, right? I mean, you've overlooked the whole fact that they create most of the oxygen we breathe. It's incredible. Just through photosynthesis, they're right at the start of the food chain. Water snails gobble up all that algae. Fish eat the snails, birds eat the fish, and on it goes. You get the idea?
Snails? Full of all that algae for dinner? No wonder fish poo is green.
That's a sweeping generalisation, and green poo can be perfectly normal. Let's move on. Next up, something Mal and I know all about, because we are bacteria! Bacteria, like me and Mal, are single-celled chaps. And some kinds of bacteria can make you unwell. Those pesky germs. But the vast majority of us couldn't be more different. Loads of us are even helpful.
Oh, yes. I'd forgotten about all the bleeding bacteria do-gooders. Oh, they get right on my nerves. I wouldn't mind, but they do go on about it. Ooh, we're so helpful breaking down a variety of foodstuffs into nutrients so easy for the human body to absorb. Gets right on my wick.
It's true, though, isn't it? Bacteria, all single-celled microbes, come in a literally immense variety. And in your body, there are 10 times as many bacterial cells than human cells. You are more bacteria than you are a person. So it's a good job they're mostly nice like me. There are lots in your guts, as much as a kilogram, helping you break down food mostly. You also get bacteria in a huge amount of yummy food. Like a bit of yogurt? Who doesn't? Well, you can't make it without bacteria. Next up, we have...
Protozoa! Plasmodium is my absolute fave protozoan, a nasty little microbe that causes malaria. It invades the red blood cells, multiplies inside them, making them burst open. It would kill you if you didn't take medicine or make you really badly ill, at least.
That's just not nice. You get plenty of decent, hard-working protozoa that keep their heads down. They just get on with their business gobbling up germs in sewage farms. They don't hurt anyone. Look at the amoeba too. Nicest protozoa you could hope to meet. And you should see them shapeshift. It's quite a trick, I can tell you. They make it look simple.
Oh yeah, they're simple all right.
Don't give microbes a bad name, Mal. Let's move it on. Viruses. Okay, viruses. Yeah, well, they are pretty horrible, really. Can't really argue with the facts. Go on then, you're clearly the expert here.
Viruses are really tiny, non-living parasites. To survive, they have to find cells to invade. These are the host cells. Each virus has its own favourite host. Could be a human cell, a bird cell, or even a bacterial cell. And once inside, they start multiplying, producing copies of themselves.
They like to take over and make you feel ill, basically. Never really got on with viruses, have to be honest there. Chalk and cheese. Different.
Not that different. Don't flatter yourself. We're all microbes.
Indeed we are. Oh, I think I might possibly be about to divide. How about you, Mal?
Yeah, definitely feeling dividey.
Dividing is something we bacteria can't help doing. Making copies of ourselves by splitting in two, basically. Here we go. So, anyway, we better go. As you can see, microbes come in all sorts. Vast majority don't bother humans at all and can even be helpful. I hope Mal and I have been helpful microbes for you today.
You definitely have. Thanks, Benny and Mal. See you next time.
Follow the adventures of Benny and Mal on funkidslive.com/bugs. Good Bug, Bad Bug, produced with support from the Society for General Microbiology.
Yeah, you can listen to all of our Benny and Mal adventures for free on your phone or tablet. Get to the free Fun Kids app. Get them wherever you get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes. And you can always have a listen at funkidslive.com. Now, remember, if you've got a science question that's knocking around your head and you can't quite iron out the answer, maybe you need an expert to help you out with it, well, the easiest way is to get over to the iTunes podcast store and ask me the question in the comments section on there while you're leaving us a review. And then I'll do the rest. I'll find someone really, really smart to help answer it for you. Now, Freddie has just done that. He's dropped us 5 stars as well on the iTunes podcast store. Thanks so much, pal. And he says, how does a volcano erupt? I mean, it's a brilliant question, Freddie, when you think about it. Why does molten rock from deep down near the Earth's core get thrown through the sky? Where does all that pressure come from? Why is it so hot? Well, I don't need an expert to answer this for you, Freddie, because I've already asked one. Now, you'll need to go back through all of our shows that you can find online or on your phone or tablet, open up the podcast store, and listen to the show, the Fun Kids Science Weekly, from the 12th of August last year. It's called Explosive Eruptions and the Deadliest Snake in the World. And in that episode, we chat to a proper volcanologist. This is his job. His name is Peter Rowley, and he explains exactly why volcanoes erupt and how they're formed. So there you go, Freddie. A little mission for you, mate. Thanks so much for getting in touch. Now, I've got a mission for you. If there's a science question that you can't quite figure out the answer to, well, let me know and I'll get an expert to sort it out. Just head over to the iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, leave us a review on there, write the question you want answered in the comment box, and I'll sort it out, don't worry. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, have you ever had an idea that you think might just change the world? Like, you've got some invention in your brain that's rocking around there, it's niggling you, and you want to tell everyone about it. Well, there is a way. It's the Bright Ideas Challenge, and you've got just 2 weeks left to enter, and we've got Bobby Seagull and Emma Wire on the line to tell us more. Hello.
Hi there.
So, tell me more about this. So, the Bright Ideas Challenge, what's the point in trying to kind of harvest all these ideas? What are we trying to change?
So the Bright Ideas Challenge was created to help inspire the next generation of scientists and engineers. And we're particularly looking to tackle a real challenge that we see in the future. So we know more and more people are living in cities, and the future of our cities is incredibly important. So how do we make those cities vibrant, healthy and clean places to live? And so we're looking for 11 to 14 year olds to come up with solutions to how to power those future cities. So how can we power those cities in a way that is healthy and clean and helps those cities be vibrant places to live?
Now, Emma, you are an engineer. You work with fuel engineering at Shell.
That's right, yep.
Now, what ideas do you think are likely to come up when we're talking of powering cities in the future? Is it stuff that we already know? Hydrogen, nuclear, or maybe people might come up with things that are brand new, the ways that we can power things?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be really amazing if people come up with ideas that are brand new, or different ways of harnessing those ideas we already know about, or different ways of applying things that already exist. We're looking for really everything that they can possibly think of to try and tackle this question of what options might we have of powering cities in the future.
We're not just here to talk about the fact we've got just 2 weeks left to enter. Also, there's a load of research that's been published about how kids today are getting involved in science and how they think about trying to change the future. Bobby, can you just give us a few headlines of what you found?
Yeah, so it's really optimistic research by Shell, Dan. So it says that 93% of children age 11 to 14, they're confident that they have the ability to change the world for the better, and they think they can do that through science and engineering. And even more, over half of them want to change the world by making people's lives better. So it's a really altruistic, positive way of seeing the world. And I know I'm a teacher. I teach 11, 12, 13-year-olds. Sometimes kids get a bad reputation. You know, all they want to do is be YouTube stars or be a TV celebrity. But actually, the research has shown that young people do really want to use science, technology, engineering to actually make an impact on the lives of other people. And that's such a positive, good news story to share.
And as a maths teacher yourself, how do schools try and change this from the ground up? How are you trying to promote maybe not thinking about all the material goals in life, but maybe helping other people?
Yeah, I think with students, if you teach in an abstract manner, just make them look at, let's say, I don't want to denigrate the name of Pythagoras, but well, Pythagoras theorem. If they study it in a vacuum, they don't really see the purpose of it. I think they switch off. But if you can show them that there's a reason behind doing this, a reason for getting into maths so you can access the sciences, then you can actually come up with inventions, ideas, projects that can actually impact thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people across the world. That really motivates children. So it's trying to find a way of hooking them in. And I think the Bright Ideas Challenge is something that I will definitely be advocating to my students, so they can actually try and get into teams of, I think, up to five, come up with an idea of tackling problems in cities.
Bobby, this is going to sound probably quite a random question, but working in maths where everything is already almost, I guess, almost been found out, really, because it's through logic, it's through one and one makes another thing. What bright ideas can we have for maths, solely for that, for trying to change the future of maybe how we're working sums out, how we're using logic to look at the world around us?
Yeah, the thing is, maths is so powerful. Like my students, we were learning, I think, a couple of weeks ago, looking at prime numbers, and my kids are saying, "Sir, what's the point of prime numbers? Why do I need to know 2, 3, 5, 7? And I told my kids, "Do all of you have phones? Yes. Do all of you have WhatsApp? Yes. Do your parents ever use a chip and pin?" And I tell them, "Do you know how the data's protected securely? Through encryption. And do you know what they use? They use prime numbers. They multiply two massive prime numbers to come up with another number, and that's how they encrypt data. So without prime numbers, we wouldn't have any sort of security in emails or WhatsApp. So maths is so powerful. Of course, maths is it's called often the queen of the sciences. When Emma, in her daily job as a fuel scientist, she uses numbers. But of course, maths in itself can unlock so many other things. And again, I always use that example with kids, saying how prime numbers are used in every single daily life application for sending data securely.
What about the future of maths, though? Because with science, I think we can still recognise how it's being used every single day to try and understand some of the fundamental fabric and the things that make up the core of the universe, black holes, singularities. But what happens with maths? It's we know what sums do. We know what, how the times table works. We know how division works. What's the future of maths? What are we still trying to figure out?
Yeah, I think again, it's a very good question, because I think with the science and mathematics, so of course all the sort of basic ground level stuff, all our, you know, building blocks of maths, our numeracy, arithmetic, that's all there. But it's about trying to push the frontier. So there are people looking at geometries. For example, there was a $1 million prize problem recently where someone worked out the geometries of a sphere. I think it's really hard to explain it in about 30 seconds, but they looked at a sphere, compared it to a donut, and they looked at the different surfaces of these. So there's so much more science that people are coming up with. And I think to get to the level of understanding does take years. You do need to do a master's, a PhD. But with mathematics, it's, I think, almost an exploration of human ingenuity and wit. Again, I could say to writers, why are you writing a book? You know, surely every single idea, every single story has already been come up with. Yeah, possibly, but coming up with a new spin, a new sort of way of looking at it. So I think the same with mathematics. There's new ways and new insights that people with a fresh mind and young perspective can bring to it.
Now, Emma, working at Shell, as a fuel scientist, what are you looking to gain out of this Bright Ideas Challenge? Because it seems fuel is a subject that almost gets more controversial day by day. How are we going to use what limited resources we've got left? How are we going to try and change the world in the future? What are you looking to get out of this?
So we're looking to use the Bright Ideas Challenge as a way to inspire the next generation of scientists and engineers, because these will be the people who will solve these problems in terms of how we fuel our cars or power our engines, fly our planes, or what energy we use to fly our planes and heat our homes will be solved by scientists and engineers in the generations to come. So the Bright Ideas Challenge is an opportunity to get involved, try out your skills and problem solving and science and engineering skills to try and come up with a solution to this question of how we might power cities in the future.
I'm going to take this chance to give you my bright idea, if that's okay. It's something that's been kind of niggling away at me for a while, and I don't know why we can't do it, apart from probably the effort. Mm-hmm. Why can't we line the roads and all the motorways, where no one cares what they look like, with solar panels? Why would that not work?
You mean line the sides of the roads with solar panels?
Yeah.
So I think there's loads of options going on in terms of how solar is used and where it is. And of course, it's about how do you... The initial benefit of solar, of course, is that it's renewable. But the big challenge is how do you store the energy that you're getting from it? So how do we make sure that we can get that energy that's created to the right places? And although that takes time and infrastructure to do that. So, you know, there'll be loads of future options around solar, but also all kinds of different energy solutions being looked at, and making sure that it's that balance of all of these different options that are going to help us in the future.
And if I wanted to submit my fantastic solar panel M25 idea, how would I do it? Where do I go online to find out more about the Bright Ideas Challenge?
So to find out more about the Bright Ideas Challenge, you need to go online to www.shell.co.uk/brightideaschallenge. There's loads of resources and information on there. It's targeted at 11 to 14 year olds, so I'm guessing you might be out of that age category, Dan. But if not, then please do go on there and submit your idea.
Fantastic. Oh, very quickly, Bobby, before we go, this sheet of paper in front of me, all about you, says that you once played football with Prince Harry at Eton College. Are you going to the wedding?
I'm awaiting my invite, but I'm hoping that Prince Harry sees I'm involved with the Bright Ideas Challenge and thinks, what a good man, promoting science for this country. So I'm awaiting Prince Harry's invite.
Very diplomatic answer. Bobby, Emma, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you so much.
It's time for today's Dangerous Dan, where we talk about the most deadly and evil things in the universe. Now this week, it's all about a tiny, single-celled organism that's so hungry it's going to eat your brain. Naegleria fowleri, it's microscopic, it's just 10 micrometres big. Bear in mind, the width of a single strand of the hair on your head is 5 times the size of that. Now this is an amoeba, which is a single-celled organism, one of the most simplest forms of life in the world. So it's tiny, it's simple, but it's known in a different, way more deadly way. Its nickname is the brain-eating amoeba. Now, they live in warm water, so it's found in freshwater, lakes, ponds, puddles. They can't live in salt water, so they're never going to be in the sea, don't worry. Mostly, though, they're found in tropical freshwater around the southern tip of the United States, you know, places like Florida and Mexico. Now, these amoebas, they're sucked in through the nose of people who swim in the water, and then they get to work. These tiny, simple, single cells, they start eating your brain. it causes you to have a headache. I mean, obviously, I think that's probably the easiest thing that happens. They're eating your brain. It causes you a fever as well. You're sick, you vomit, you start to hallucinate. You can't see. And then, since there's no strict cure that they've found, you end up dying. See why it's in danger, Stan? One of the most smallest forms of life in the ocean is one of the deadliest things in there. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We've got a car expert coming on the show in just a sec, by the way. He's here to answer probably the smartest question that I think we've ever been sent into the show. It's all about the petrol in a fuel tank and what happens to it and how gravity works with it when you're going uphill. First, it's time to catch up with Techno Mum, and she investigates all the smart science behind the things that we use every single day.
Techno Mum Fast Files.
Can you imagine having to press a button on the front of the telly to change the channel? Luckily, lazy bones, you don't need to, thanks to the remote control. That's the zapper. Zappers are handy because they're not attached to the telly. It's a bit like remote control toys. They have controllers that aren't attached, which makes playing with them a lot more fun. Both types of controllers use invisible waves to send instructions around. The TV remote has a circuit board inside that turns your orders into digital information made of ones and noughts. These orders are sent in light waves, made by a light-emitting diode, or LED, that you can't see, but which a receiver in the telly can decode. The remote-controlled car uses radio waves, like the sort you hear on your radio, but these are just sending instructions to the toys. How many toys or gadgets do you have that have separate controllers?
Techno Mum, with the Institution of Engineering and Technology, advancing and sharing knowledge.
It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, you know that if there's something sciencey that's kind of niggling away at your brain, I don't know, maybe you can't figure out why something is the way it is, well, you can ask me and I'll get it answered by an expert for you. Now, this is from Max, sent to my page at funkidslive.com. He is 6. He says, if a car is going up a really steep hill and you've only got a little bit of petrol left, will the car still drive despite the petrol moving to the furthest end of the tank while you're climbing the hill? I mean, Max, I think it's all to do with where the hole is in the petrol tank. But I mean, I'm no car expert. Quentin Wilson is, though. He's on the line. Hello, Quentin.
Hello.
Now, very quickly before I get the answer, what is your qualification for answering this question from Max?
Okay, well, I've been a motion journalist for 30-odd years, and I've bought and sold a few hundreds of cars and taken them to pieces, and kind of know how they work. So I think I'm in a good position to answer this question for you, Max.
Fantastic. So go for it, from Max. If a car is going up a really steep hill, you've only got a little bit of petrol left, will it still climb?
Okay, Max, this is a great, great question. If the fuel level in a car's tank is very low, then meaning if you go up a steep gradient, the gravity will send that petrol or diesel away from the fuel pickup pipe in the tank. So that means the engine will run rough, it'll stall, and it'll get what's called fuel starvation. Now, it's interesting you ask this question, Max, because people in San Francisco with older cars, if they park on steep hills, they say that their fuel gauges go right down to empty, and sometimes they're difficult to start, so they have to park them the other way around so they can do a kind of rolling start. So the moral of the story here, Max, is don't have low fuel in your tank. Always drive around like we grown-ups do with at least half a tank, and then this will never happen.
But Quentin, why don't they just put the fuel hole at the back of the tank so then gravity, it can never work against how the engine's functioning?
Well, then what would happen if you parked it in the opposite direction? So all the fuel would go to the front of the tank. So it's not quite as simple as that, Dan. A lot of car manufacturers put the thing in the middle. So this tends to affect older cars. But the fact remains is if you run around with very little fuel in your tank, you can have this happen to you. So keep it at least half full.
Fantastic. Quentin, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Pleasure. And a great question, man.
Right, let's do that science in the news thing. Have you seen this? Some companies from the UK are investing in space travel. Both Boeing and Rolls-Royce, who make engines, one for jets, the other for cars, and some planes as well, they're helping to pay for a propulsion system, part jet engine, part rocket engine, which they think will help transform the space launch market, and it'll usher in hypersonic travel around the Earth. Also, when Lionel Messi scores for Barcelona, study has found that the whole city quite literally shakes. Scientists, they installed a seismometer, which is used to measure earthquakes. They put it near the Nou Camp, which is Barcelona's stadium in Spain. And it shows a clear spike in the data where the earth actually shakes when the team have scored and the crowd are jumping about. And finally, the Atlantic Ocean circulation system is weaker now than it has been for more than 1,000 years. You see, this is how warm water is moved around the ocean, and it helps keep countries warm, it helps keep life living, but the current isn't as strong anymore. Scientists think that maybe this is as a result of the melting ice, and it's likely to continue, they say, and temperatures around the UK are going to get even colder. So in the few minutes that are left of this week's Fun Kids Science Weekly, do you think we've got the time to travel back 100 million years? Let's see how we get on. We're headed to the age of the dinosaurs, taking a look at meat eaters and plant eaters and seeing who's the best.
The Jurassic period was home to thousands of different dinosaurs, big and small. One easy way to learn about them is to split them into two groups, the meat-eaters, or carnivores, and the plant-eaters, or herbivores. Of course, some dinosaurs are both. Look out! Here comes a well-known carnivore, the Megalosaurus.
He's getting very close, and he's enormous!
Megalosaurus was a terrifying predator that was almost 9 meters long. That's twice as high as a double-decker bus. He had powerful jaws and sharp teeth, perfect for ripping through his prey's thick skins and swallowing huge chunks of flesh. His teeth were serrated. That means zigzag-shaped along the edge, like a saw, and could slice through flesh easily. Standing on his hind legs, with short forearms and a huge head, he looked quite like Tyrannosaurus. Although since T-Rex wasn't to appear for many millions of years, they would never have met. As well as razor-sharp teeth and strong jaws, predators have large eyes for finding their prey. We can tell this in dinosaur fossils from the shape of the bones in the skull, which reveal the size of the eyes. The eyes would have faced slightly forward, like in a bird of prey. This allowed them to judge distances accurately, helping with hunting.
Ugh, what's that horrible smell?
Another sign of a meat eater is found in their brains, whose impressions are left deep in the skull. The part of the brain involved in smelling was very large in carnivores. Many meat-eating dinosaurs would eat dead animals as well as live ones, so sniffing out rotting carcasses, sometimes as much as a kilometre away, was important.
Watch out, there's some giant feet heading this way.
You might think the herbivores sound a bit less scary, but they were some of the hugest creatures that ever lived. Diplodocus is one of the best known herbivores, a huge sauropod who stood a whopping 26 meters long with a long neck, perfect for reaching leaves at the top of tall trees. Lots of herbivores had many rows of teeth, sometimes pencil-shaped to rake the vegetation, other times rounder or blunt-like spoons to rip leaves from the branches. Teeth were constantly replaced as they broke or wore down, which would have happened a lot. To get enough vegetation to keep their huge bodies going, those teeth would have been busy. Whilst broad-snouted sauropods wouldn't have been picky eaters, those dinosaurs with narrower mouths could pick particular plants and so may have had a favourite. Others, like the Stegosaurus, had horny beaks that could slice through the toughest vegetation.
Paleontology. Pick.
How can paleontologists be so sure about what dinosaurs ate? Well as the shape of their skeletons, size of stomach cavities and the type of teeth, there's another way. Because what goes in must come out. That's right, fossil poo. Called a coprolite. It can help scientists understand the relationships between animals and plants. Seeds, bones, fish scales, or vegetation can be identified and give us an accurate picture of what a dinosaur liked to eat. Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
The new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk alongside life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds. of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk.
But watch out for what's around the corner.
If you want to travel back in time again in your own time, well, we've got loads more of those Age of the Dinosaurs adventures that you can listen to for free on the Fun Kids app on your phone or tablet. Also, wherever you get your podcast from, you know, places like iTunes. And also, they're all there at funkidslive.com. And while you're there, check out all the brilliant Fun Kids science theories, some that you've heard today on the show, and we've got loads more there for you to catch up on too. Right, we'll be back next week with another Fun Kids Science Weekly, exploring more of the most weird, wacky, wonderful and downright deadly things in the universe. And remember, you can listen to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on the free Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.